Times. Senator Ted Cruz in Texas and Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri, as well as Trump himself. Masters, who has campaigned on the notion that psychopaths are running the country right now and is spoken approvingly of the anti-establishment philosophy of 1990s, Ona Bomber and Vance, a frequent speaker on the university circuit during his book tour days, who now says universities are the enemy, fit the same mold. They and Till all have ties to a branch of the new right known as NatCon, whose adherents believe broadly that the establishment needs to be torn down, much as Till and his fellow Silicon Valley disruptors believed 2 decades ago that the future lay in destroying long-standing business models and practices. Till himself opined as far back as 2009 that he no longer believed democracy to be compatible with freedom and expressed little hope that voting will make things better. While a member of Trump's presidential transition team in 2016, he flashed his institution-busting instincts by proposing that a leading climate change skeptic, William Happer, be appointed as White House science advisor. He also pushed for a libertarian Bitcoin entrepreneur who did not believe in drug trials to head up the Food and Drug Administration. Such proposals were too much even by Trump's iconoclastic standards. Steve Bannon, Trump's ultra-right campaign manager and political strategist, told a Till biographer, "Peter's idea of disrupting government is out there." Till did not respond to a request for an interview, and these representatives did not respond to multiple invitations to comment. Masters and Vance also did not respond to inquiries. Chi-Sun Lee, an expert on campaign finance who directs the Brennan Center's elections and government program at New York University, said, "It does seem to be getting worse. Outside spending in this federal midterm cycle is more than double the last midterm cycle. Since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. And now we are seeing a troubling new trend that some mega donors are sponsoring campaigns that attack the fundamentals of democracy itself." Till's spending has been dwarfed this year by at least three other mega donors: Soros, $128 million to the Democrats; shipping products tycoon Richard Olhain, $53 million to Republicans; and hedge fund manager Kenneth Griffin, $50 million to Republicans. And Till has some way to go to match the consistent giving cycle after cycle of the Koch brothers, or Sheldon Adelson, the late Las Vegas casino magnate. Many experts also believe the attack on democracy began long before it became as explicit as Till has made it, because the whole point of funneling large amounts of money into the political system is to sway policy away from the will of the majority to the narrow interests of the donors and their friends. This ability to control the policy agenda drives spending even more than the desire to see specific candidates win, says Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, whose 2011 book Republic Lost offers an enduringly devastating analysis of the relationship between money and political influence. And the spending is likely only to increase. You're going to see much, much bigger individual contributions and an acceleration of contributions to super PACs, like the ones established to support Vance and Masters, Lessig said, adding, the candidates and the super PACs can't coordinate on spending, but that doesn't mean they can't coordinate on the fundraising. Since the super PACs are outspending candidates by orders of magnitude, it's all a dance to flush money into super PACs. They basically call the shots, and politicians can get anything through that they oppose. Less than a month from the election day, both Vance and Masters are trailing their Democratic opponents in the polls, Vance by less than Masters, but Lessig says it would be wrong to conclude Thiel or any of the other mega donors are wasting their money. If you're a candidate and you know $10 million is going to come in against you on a particular issue, you are going to bend to avoid the effect of that money, whether or not it's going to decide the race. If you're someone who would otherwise be a strong climate activist, but you know that if you mention a carbon tax, $1 million will drop from some anti-carbon tax super PAC, you won't talk about it, he said. Thiel's bid to overthrow the system, in other words, goes well beyond his ability to determine which party controls the Senate next year. The money will solidify the notion that the country is being run by psychopaths, at least among a hardcore of Republican voters, analysts warn, and will further harden the ideological battle lines that have split the country in two and made common ground ever harder to find. It also brings the extreme opinions of Nat Confeder into the mainstream, making it easier for radical Republican candidates to run and win in future races, they say. We are at a crisis point here. Not so much because the ideas are hard to defeat, but we don't have a context in which to defeat them, Lessig said, adding, the fact that the same number of people believe the election was stolen as believed it on January 6 is a profound indictment of the information ecology in America. The Brennan Center believes there are ways of improving the system, at least at the state and local level, and points to efforts in both red and blue states to close certain loopholes and introduce public financing models to rein in the influence of the mega donors. Lee said she would also like to see federal legislation to build a meaningful firewall between campaign funds and super PACs. She said the legislation exists and it would be a constitutional improvement even under the Citizens United ruling. All we need is the political will to act.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular Kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kaluts. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kaluts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. I'm Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky. But studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Mega Dunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Mega Dunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutz or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutz area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutz, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutz are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz. But the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kalutz or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain. and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutes of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutes in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutes in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutes. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutes for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutes, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kalutes redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeved shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent, and as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of glasses, sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and these goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kalutz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kalutz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kalutz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalut's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalut's with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as kalate and kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kalutz of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Siyuge Mountains back there towards the kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Basij, manifestation of self-sacrifice and martyrdom. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Basij Week. Basij Week reminds us of volunteer forces who selflessly devoted themselves to the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution and in full obedience to Imam Khomeini cast fear in the hearts of enemies and ill-wishers, as if the Basij forces have signed their holy covenant with their blood since they never step back till their last breath. Great martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani had said, "The condition for martyrdom is to be a martyr. No one can become a scholar before acquiring knowledge." He meant that unless one lives like a martyr, he would never deserve to be killed in the way of God. By the way, how can one live the life of a martyr? Let us first understand the meaning of martyrdom in Islam. In Islam, a martyr is specifically a person who starts fighting the enemies and is killed in the way of God. But it has a broader meaning, as the Quran says that those who have faith in God and His Apostle, they are indeed the truthful and martyrs with their Lord. A hadith from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, reads, "When a seeker of knowledge dies while acquiring it, he passes away a martyr." The Prophet also says, "He who dies with the love of my progeny will die a martyr." According to the Islamic culture, those who march in the path of truth and die while fulfilling their duties, they die as martyrs, just as reaching the summit of a mountain requires to pass the slopes. Achieving martyrdom requires passing through the lower steps. This is what Martyr Soleimani meant. The first phase of servitude of God is to know that everything is from Him, even our soul. A martyr only thinks of fulfilling his duty and pleasing God. Thus, he will never think of richness or poverty. Neither will he be worried about victory or defeat. Of course, martyrdom is a stage of wise life. The Noble Quran makes it clear in Surah Al Imran that martyrs are not dead, but they are living and provided for near the Lord. Defending the oppressed is one of the most important divine duties. Imam Ali, peace upon him, said his children in the last moments of his life, "Be the enemy of oppressors and helper of the oppressed." The Imam has not limited his word to a specific religion. Defending the oppressed is the core of a struggle in the way of God. Martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari says, "War with the aim of employing economic or human forces of a nation is by no means acceptable in Islam. In view of Islam, such wars are a kind of oppression. Jihad can only be legitimate as defense and, in fact, a struggle against aggression. Today, war has found broader dimensions. As for the cultural, economic, or political wars, it is not the geographical borders that are invaded. It is rather the divine borders and the borders of humanity, freedom, and justice that are violated. It is very hard to live a martyr in such soundless wars, as it is too difficult to distinguish an oppressor from an oppressed. A martyr is the one who does not lose the right way, as he has an indicator and guide, that is, the leader and imam who is divinely helped." The Noble Quran says, O you who have faith, obey Allah and obey the Apostle and those vested with authority among you. He who is the servant of God can be a true Basiji and a living martyr. A Basiji is a person who gives whatever he has, but he never disobeys the leader. The best role model for Basij were the 72 companions of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who sacrificed their life in the way of the Imam without thinking of the enemy. They never left their Imam alone. Their absolute obedience of the Imam keeps reverberating in the world for those who seek freedom and humanity. They tell us that the Islamic Ummah will not be monolithic and firm without the Imam. True Basiji forces are the flag bearers of vigilance. They keep awakening dormant souls in the world to stage uprising against oppressors. The Iranian Basij, the Hezbollah of Lebanon, the Hashd al-Sha'bi of Iraq, the Palestinian Hamas, and other forces in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere are the members of the Wakeful Ummah. They will never tolerate the U.S. hegemony in the world. They have indeed turned into the nightmare to shatter the dreams of the global arrogance and Zionism.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The Americans, their intention was not to leave Iraq. They then tried to appoint their own agents, but they failed completely. They failed in Iraq, they failed in Syria, and they failed in Lebanon. The recent agreement between Lebanon and the usurping regime, Israel, regarding the issue of maritime gas-filled borders and the like was a part of America's failure. This is because the Americans started ordering things. It must be done this way and that way. Hezbollah rejected all this. This is America's failure. It is obvious that their calculations are inaccurate. One of the things that I'm saying this now, some other people across the world have apparently said it too. I believe that one of the signs of America's decline is the election of people like the current and the former presidents.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A country of 300 million plus people almost destroys itself and elects a president in the previous term. Somebody like Trump, whom the world considers to be crazy, and after he was defeated, a man like this current one comes to power. And well, you know the stories about him. This is the evidence of the decline of a nation. This is evidence of the decline of a civilization. So this was matters related to America. Many other Western powers are similar to the US in these aspects. Now, I don't want to name them, but some other Western powers are like America in this field. In the media, they teach destruction. They teach people how to riot and how to make Molotov cocktails and hand grenades. What is the reason for this? This issue is not that they are committing a crime by doing this. Yes, it is a crime, but it is also depravity. This is depraved behavior. Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in the month of November. However, what Israelis cannot sabotage is the spirit of resistance among Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept noted, for 3 weeks this fall, Israeli regime forces closed all roads leading in and out of Nablus, a Palestinian city of 170,000 people and the economic hub of the occupied northern West Bank. As residents of the city and surrounding villages were locked in or out, cut off from jobs, school, family, and access to medical care, Israeli regime troops entered the city with armored vehicles, placed snipers on rooftops, shot at homes, and reportedly blocked medical crews from aiding the wounded. At least 6 people were killed and dozens were injured during the siege, which a prominent Palestinian human rights group denounced as a form of collective punishment. While the Zionist regime partially lifted the road closures earlier this month, the 21-day lockdown signaled a remarkable escalation of Israeli regime forces in a part of the West Bank that is, at least nominally, under the control of the Palestinian Authority. But the incursions and blockade of Nablus were only the latest in a growing series of Israeli regime acts of aggression in the West Bank that have put Palestinians on edge even before an Israeli regime escalation returned right-wing former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to power this month. While the territory, home to nearly 3 million people, has been under military occupation since 1967, and violence by the Zionist regime troops and settlers is relatively commonplace, the last few months have reminded residents of past surges in Israeli regime violence that were met with widespread Palestinian resistance, including during the Second Intifada of the early 2000s. You don't see the West Bank in the news like you see in Gaza. Because Gaza is bombed, you have these devastating images, videos, stories. It gets in the news, but even then, it dissipates. Yara Asi, a Palestinian-American researcher who was working in Nablus through the recent siege, told The Intercept, adding, "I think what obscures a situation that has been getting significantly worse in the West Bank. This is firmly within Area A, as designated by Oslo Accords," she added, referring to a breakdown of the occupied territories in different areas of control, with Area A being one, theoretically under the civil and security control of the Palestinian Authority, adding, "So when you hear that Israeli regime jeeps have raided the city or that they have closed the city, this just belies the whole artifice that Oslo ever was, which is that there is any place of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank." The United Nations last month warned of an explosive situation as 2022 is on track to become the deadliest year in the West Bank since 2026, with at least 105 Palestinians, including 26 children, killed there, a 57% increase over the last year. The youngest 7-year-old Rayan Soleiman died of an apparent cardiac arrest after being chased by Israeli regime troops near the city of Beit Lahem. 10 Israeli citizens, 3 foreigners, and 4 Israeli troops were killed by Palestinians from the West Bank in that time frame, according to the UN. But deaths are only one way to measure the worsening situation in the West Bank, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians also face restricted mobility, land expropriation, and economic hardships created by the occupation forces. Movement restrictions by way of the Zionist regime checkpoints and road closures in particular have been tightening, while attacks by settlers, often operating with the military's protection, have become more frequent. The olive harvesting season, when Palestinian farmers leave their villages to work in the groves, have become one of the most dangerous for them. Still, the almost routine reality of the violence Palestinians face has made it hard for observers to grasp at the big picture and take note of a perceptible shift that is further fueling anxiety and resentment. Only when you step back, you see just how alarming it is, how devastating this whole thing is, said Bhutto, stressing that violence is a built-in feature to the occupation. "I am torn between saying this is an escalation and saying this is part of what we have lived through for 55 years. The whole world is shocked by other countries, but that shock doesn't apply here in the West Bank because it's been 55 years. Uncertainty in the West Bank has been thrown into further turmoil by the result of the Zionist regime's 5th election in 4 years earlier this month, which returned Netanyahu to power and is set to give the fabricated regime of Israel its most right-wing government ever. Some Palestinians note that what happens in Israeli regime politics doesn't change the reality of the occupation. They point to the Zionist regime violence over the last year as an effort by the former government to prove that it was as tough as the right-wing opposition. If anything, Netanyahu's extremism exposes the reality of the Zionist regime's plans for continued expansion in the West Bank. It's too soon to predict whether the shift will last and how effective a new generation of Palestinian resistance groups can be. The fabricated regime of Israel's crackdown in recent months has led to the killing or arrest of much of the group's leadership, though support for them appears to be growing. Also, in response to that crackdown, the dynamic is now new, while some form of armed resistance has remained a constant. Throughout the occupation, there have been surges in Palestinians' efforts to directly confront the Zionist regime forces, and they have been promptly met with Israeli regime repression. Every so many years, you see a willingness to re-engage with a broader armed resistance, which I think is shaped in part by a distance from the severe repression that the Israeli regime brings on Palestinians every time these uprisings begin to form, said Munayir, a Palestinian activist. Whether mounting Israeli regime violence across the West Bank or over the last several months will plunge the territory back into the larger-scale fighting of the past remains in question, but it's a question Palestinians and others are increasingly voicing, with some referring to it as a simmering intifada, a big resistance. Munayir said, "I can't tell you how many times I have heard people say the next intifada has started. But I think what we are seeing reflects the overwhelming resistance of Palestinians against the Israeli regime forces." Meanwhile, Wafa news agency reported a Palestinian child was recently killed while four others were injured by the Zionist regime gunfire during confrontations that broke out with Israeli regime forces as the latter raided the eastern part of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. The ministry said in a statement that Ahmad Amjad Shahada, 16, was killed after Israeli regime forces shot him with a live bullet in the heart. The medical sources added that four other Palestinians were injured, one of them critically with a bullet in the abdomen, noting that one was hit with sound bomb in the head, while others suffered from suffocation due to inhaling toxic gas fired at them by the Zionist regime forces. According to Wafa correspondent, large units of Israeli regime forces accompanied by a military bulldozer raided the eastern area of Nablus in order to provide protection for the Zionist settlers, which sparked confrontations with Palestinians during which Israeli regime forces fired live bullets, sound toxic and tear gas bombs towards the protesters and their homes, killing one child and injured four others. The Israeli regime forces also targeted a Red Crescent vehicle with live bullets. Dozens of Israeli regime settlers raided the area of Joseph Tomb under protection from Zionist forces. With the Zionist regime killing of Shahada, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli regime forces rises to 200, including 57 minors, according to reports by the Palestinian Ministry of Health.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions, but so far I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse